You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it's the 24th of August, 2022. There's never any shortage of things to cover. There's a few things before we begin, other than my traditional appeal for financial assistance. Relevant to that appeal is, of course, gas prices. Now, I said when this first happened that this has nothing to do with any kind of supply bottleneck, because American supplies of oil that it has to import, which is only a portion, haven't been affected at all. So this should have nothing to do with American prices. Of course, there is no gas market. It's just an industry. And it's certainly more powerful than at least in the West, than states. I also made the claim early on that, gouging is the norm. This is simply a matter of price gouging for that very reason, not only because there is no market, but because American supplies have not been affected in the least. And today, of course, I've received proof of that, in that in the first quarter, maybe the first quarter and a half of 2022, the oil firms have registered the highest profits in their history. We're closing on $100 billion when you put them all together, with massive bonuses for the CEOs and those under them, which goes to show it has nothing to do with supply. It has everything to do with gouging. Europe may be a different story, but the U.S. has very little to do with Russian oil, and most American sources come from South America, America itself, Norway, the UK, and Saudi Arabia, depending on the time frame. So I was right about that clearly. This has nothing to do. There is no gas market. That's number one. Number two, and this is relevant to what we're going to deal with today, I want to talk about the Ukraine war. I strongly recommend you read Paul Craig Roberts' last analysis of it, especially since, he's not really known for that kind of thing. And the upshot of it all is that, as I said some months ago, the Ukrainian army which was about 500,000, with massive investments from the West since at least 2014, has long since fallen apart. You don't have any real centralized command that isn't at least American. This war, of course, has artificially been extended. So complaints from Ukrainians at the front, and I have at least one video on it, says the following. Number one, the Russians have already destroyed most of the heavy weaponry of the Ukrainians using target-correcting drones. So they say that they only have small arms. They don't have any heavy weapons. Number two, what's left can never sleep because they're constantly under attack from artillery and aviation. Number three, no artillery support whatsoever. They're completely decentralized, and so there's no coordination. Number four, they're complaining about bodies of their own men who there's no one to take them, and there's nowhere for them to go. They simply remain where they stand. And the same thing, number five, the wounded are not evacuated. They have to walk a certain distance, and if they can't walk, then they simply are left to die. That these decentralized commanders are dealing with severe, as I said in the beginning, severe desertion problem, and they're threatening execution on the spot for anyone who does that. They wouldn't say that unless it was already a major problem. And that the army largely now has ceased to exist. This was Russia's sole purpose here. Russia's sole purpose was to demilitarize and to protect eastern Ukraine, and nothing farther than that. Of course, that was done a long time ago. And you can't expect a third world country like Ukraine to be able to stand up to anyone. Of course, Ukraine isn't Georgia. Even though Georgia was getting weapons from abroad, Ukraine, of course, is much larger and much more strategic. And since, at least, I'll say even 2004, the artificial, and this is a country that's been losing GDP constantly, has its military built up far beyond their capacity to wield. And, of course, anything that happens is connected to Americans, military intelligence, and the CIA, not homegrown Ukrainians who are largely there for political reasons. Like all the other Western states or Western-style states, their military brass was purged a long time ago, at least after Kuchma's reign was over. So you have political placeholders rather than commanders who were promoted through merit. The American press has no idea what's going on there, so they can take their marching orders from the Department of State and the Department of Defense. As you all know, you can't believe any of it. And thanks to very smooth and patient Russian diplomacy, even Turkey has come over to the Russian side. It's largely over for Ukraine. It's been over for months. Russia could have done far worse. But again, most of eastern Ukraine is pro-Russian and is going to be either an independent state or a dependency of Russia or something along the lines of Crimea. In other words, and this is being said from all over the place, Russian forces have been victorious. They've been victorious since at least the middle of March. They've long since taken all the major roadways connecting Kiev to the east. These weapons are that they've been given, with only a handful have been trained on it, have largely been destroyed. The ratio of losses is probably 20 to 1. In other words, you know, for every 20 Ukrainian soldiers destroyed, the Russians may lose one. And so who's fighting now are these territorial militias, also armed by the West. They're regular personnel the losses have been enormous. And more importantly, though, I mean, the Air Force was destroyed on the ground early on, but back in late February. Fuel has long since been gone. So you have this decentralized guerrilla action from the territorials, who are generally very poorly trained and usually older, almost like something like a National Guard. And Roberts says what I've been saying too. The strategy has been not only the slow but sure movement, but, you know, doing a lot of reconnaissance, through drones. They correct targets and with real video target video in real time, relay to commanders these, you know, your typical raw coordinates. And then, of course, the second is, you know, with real time video, destroy the fortifications with either their towed or mobile artillery, thermobaric munitions, and multiple launch rocket systems. And they are gradiated, of course, in strength for targets that require them. And then it's over. You know, again, as Robert says, you let the smoke clear and you repeat step one. The broader point I'm making, of course, is just like everything that Putin does, the strategy has been classically Russian, but also relatively slow because so many Ukrainians are pro-Russian. The Ukrainian government or the American colonial administration wouldn't have to ban every single pro-Russian media source if Russia wasn't popular in the country. That I've been saying for a very long time. Even in the far West, you don't have this overwhelming hatred of the Russians. Now, that being said, of course, I have to mention the assassination or execution of Daria Dugina. Of course, it's not a surprise that this was a very sloppy operation, regardless of of who the target was, although Daria's was a target in her own right. Given the sloppy, probably semi-American organization, I think maybe deliberately sloppy, the facts of the matter are clear. Of course, the murder was planned by the special services of Ukraine, but that's just another link to the Americans. Now, the direct perpetrator, as many of you know already, Natalia Volk, who not that long ago left the Russian Federation for Estonia, and then back to Russia, arriving on July 23rd. Volk and her daughter, Sofia Shaban, I'm very suspicious about that name, rented an apartment in the very same house where Daria Dugina lived in Moscow. Many of you have already seen the Mini Cooper, which was used to spy. The license plates were changed at least three times that we know of. Both the DPR, as well as Kazakhstan and Ukraine itself. Many of you have seen her identification, which I'm looking at right now, for 1979. So she was both a regular member of the services, as well as Azov. And remember, the Shaban name, which is, her maiden name, too, is a suspicious one. And a lot of information on her was leaked by Russian hackers back in the springtime. There was a leak of substantial Ukrainian special services documents, and her name came up several times. I also tend to think, looking at her picture from her daughter's Instagram, that she's had a lot of plastic surgery. Now, that might make sense given her age and given the fact that she's a high income earner, relative to Ukraine, of course, but also possibly to disguise her, because the Instagram pictures don't quite match her her identification. Clearly, she's had work done. It may be subtle in some places, but I'm seeing a substantial difference. So at least it's been solved. And it's an act of terror. Whether they meant to kill Alexander or not is irrelevant. Of course, the American press, the exact same headline, using the exact same words, Putin's brain and all that. I didn't know they know each other. Of course, that's completely invented and made up. It's rare that Dugin has any articles on actionable policy. Nor has there ever been any evidence that he has any kind of direct influence on Moscow's decision-making. They also, all the press uses the word Rasputin as if they know anything, and he had very little influence over policy. So their error and their propaganda is on multiple layers. So, again, it's unfortunate most of Dugin's work hasn't been translated. So the American journalists who pretend to write on them have no idea what they're saying. They rarely actually cite or quote him. And when they do, it's copy and paste. Even, quotes you can get anywhere. They're very common ones, the same ones over and over again. And usually in a language that they simply misinterpret terminology. That being said now, I want to talk about Alexander Dugin. He has been forced to stare death in the face. I guarantee you that he would rather it be him in there than her. At a minimum, this event forces us to try to comprehend the times that we live in, which is one of the things that I do here. And an understanding of eschatology, understanding of really the theological approach to history, is indispensable. And there is a very specific Russian way of viewing history and its eras, so that the current situation is not nearly as mysterious. And so I want to take from a few non-translated works of his on Christian history. I've taken them from a few places and get to the bottom of what this is really all about. Of course, Vladimir Lossky, as I've said before, notes that each era of, you know, theological history has a point of doctrine attached to it. There's a problem or a heresy or a debate that even typifies and defines the era. In fact, this is one of the ways that we delineate them. And there's the same exists today. The doctrine of the spiritual and mysterious content of how the church functions on earth. And it is, it should be, the center of theological discussion. Christian eschatology, the Orthodox view, the content of Revelation and Daniel, traditionally misinterpreted by Westerners, needs to be explicated pretty clearly. Obviously, there's two comings of Christ. Now, for the non-Orthodox, the 2,000 years aren't... it's not a small period of time, but time doesn't mean the same to the church as it does in terms of years and months. In the spiritual realm, of course, time is simply a vehicle for working out its design. But Christian history, and therefore the end times, is critical, especially today. And of course, outside of the specific doctrines, there are key dates and periods that delineate the ages one from another, and these have a spiritual meaning. And of course, these begin with Pentecost. You know, 50 days after the resurrection, 10 days after the ascension, and this is where the Holy Spirit was sent to the church. The functioning of the church was initiated. And this era is from apostolic time to the foundation of the Empire of Constantinople. The famous Milan Decree in 313. And it confuses Westerners because, especially Protestants, they don't understand why they're retained a certain reverence for the Roman way of doing things. Rome was always the touchstone for Christian theology, and even considered a reverential, and of course, prophetically, foreseeing its coming conversion. And it's connected to the ancient Christian teaching by the mission of the descendants of Japheth. And these were the people who were destined to lay the foundation of the universal monarchy. Point of the empire is to embody in a social, political, and economic way, the energies of the resurrection. And this, of course, goes back to the doctrine of the four kingdoms, which I've dealt with before. Babylonian, the Medo-Persian, the Greek, especially the unified Greeks, Greek world of Alexander, and, of course, the last is Roman. So there is a important significance of Rome, and it's not an accident that the Talmud condemns it under various code words over and over. The scrawlings on the wall of the Ipatiev house, the execution of Tsar Nicholas and his family, makes reference to it. But there's another related and complementary doctrine of the seven we might call righteous kingdoms. And after the fall, the last of them, the eighth, after the fall of the seventh, there is another. The unrighteous kingdom should begin, the kingdom of Antichrist. And to a great extent, it's our time. But that seventh, the last righteous kingdom, the seven righteous, one unrighteous, originates, of course, from St. Constantine. But the last kingdom is a central doctrine and understanding our times. This is about the Greek center of the church, and as I've said 100 times before, the culture of early Christianity was Greek. But still, during these first centuries, the church existed close to the world, and it was close to a decrepit world. It contradicted the surrounding reality in social state and in the natural sense. So the first stage The first stage is distinguished by the ethics, as Dugin says, the ethics of communication with the world. And a special ontology, or a concept of existence, the reality of the church on the one hand, and the reality of the, for lack of a better term, the non-Christian or pagan, or even Judaic world on the other. Now, the Holy Spirit is a manifestation of God via energy. Just what the earlier fathers make that connection very clear. And, of course, this is the foundation of the Eucharist and Jesus Christ himself. But the way to put it is, as Dugin does, is the reality of the church on earth at the time is a qualitative link with the uncreated world, which is removed from the exclusivity of the old world, or the yoke of the law, the yoke of false righteousness, and to a great extent of Solomon, which separated, like the scythe and the Soviet flag, separated the created from the uncreated. And it continues, of course, to exist. In other words, this is the building of something new. Now, there is a meaning of the term new, which is very important. And it can't be overemphasized. Concepts like, you know, the new man, the New Testament, a new hope. This is important. New is extremely powerful. It didn't mean any kind of just a chronological sequence or change without any terminus. New, of course, is a metaphysical term. It characterizes, as he says, an intra-church mode of being, which heals that separation between created and uncreated. And it's based on the discovery, the path of what we call volitional deification of the creature, coming from the sacrifice of the Son of God. So new is a person in whom the seed of communion with the divine has been impressed. The new life based in the New Testament means the gradual implementation of deification. Now, as you know, the French revolutionaries and the Soviets also spoke of the new man. But that is a purely, I think next week we're going to deal with Dugin's concept of chaos, which I was recently asked about. The new man is in a closed-off world, in a separated world, where the uncreated is insignificant. So there's nothing new about it. Now, there is a second, as many of you know, very important stage. The ecclesial and non-ecclesial were opposed to each other. They coexisted without mixing, in a general sense. It was a teaching early on, the first stage, about the conversion of the kingdom, about the millennial kingdom, and the fettering of Satan and limiting his action. And again, it's there was a close connection between the church and the empire, and most people can't understand the loyalty of the first Christians to the imperial laws in Roman statehood. It's only the quote-unquote religious side of Rome. And of course, they were uncompromising just in that regard. And of course, Christians were distinguished by a special valor in the Roman legions. They were highly decorated because death was far from the end. God conquered death. So St. Constantine overcame that distinction. Now the Edict of Milan is one thing. More importantly, of course, Theodosius. Theodosius the Great, making it an official state religion, which emperors after him had a tough time maintaining. Remember, every heresy had imperial support at one time or another. But it's not merely a matter of policy. It's eschatological. This is where we get the idea of the kekon, or the holding back, or the restraining, which is how the first Christians already understood the Roman kingdom. It was the political standard, which, of course, doesn't exist except ideologically. The first years are about this extreme chasm between created and uncreated on the one hand, the church, and the world on the other. Very much like the manifestation of a Platonic form on earth, you have this intermediate thing, the Orthodox Empire, based on symphony. Now that we've gone over this in great detail, both in writing and speaking. The concept being that there is a political power combined properly and harmoniously with the day-to-day work of the church. So the key concept here, the concept of ontology and anthropology when it comes to understanding the empire and the meaning relative to the end times, relative to our times. So in the monarchy, in the Orthodox kingdom, there was a brand new, a fundamentally new reality, which did not exist in the previous three centuries. Between the church on the one hand, directly associated with the uncreated, with God himself, faced off against what was left of demonic power, where, of course, the old laws, the old man, continued to function. So the battle, of course, was between this, for the creation of this intermediate level, a special protection from the sovereignty of the old man and withdrawal of his power, and that's what Decaton was. And the Apostle Paul, I guess you know this, in Paul to the Thessalonians, for the mystery of lawlessness is already in operation, only it will not be accomplished until the one who restrains or keeps it from the environment is now taken away, and then the lawless one will be revealed. This is the intermediate nature of the empire. The Caton, interpreted by tradition and by even an apostolic era, as the Orthodox emperor in the Orthodox kingdom, as an organic institution. Reality is something that is bound by the very boundaries of the Orthodox kingdom, symbolized by the walls of Constantinople. The empire is fundamentally distinct from that which exists outside of it. There's so much about the empire that can't be explained in normal terms of political science. And this comes down to the idea of symphony. The idea of theology, is cataphatic through the idea of God's creation, but within the framework of the empire, and of course its opposite. Or what's in intention with, it has a hesychastic idea, the apophatic. The attempt to understand the creator as such, the uncreated as such. So the Caton is the promised millennial kingdom, which was a temporary attack, and a temporary, I guess the word is curtailment, of demons and the old man. But of course, it's not final. Byzantium is roughly 1,000 years. It corresponds precisely. New Rome was founded as the starting point, the idea of what we can call the millennial kingdom. And the entire cycle was about 1,000 years. And the theological struggle at the time was based on this preservation, to create the battlement against the coming Antichrist. The Antichrist was supposed to follow this kingdom before Constantine. The power of demons was far more significant, but the final arrives after the millennium. There's a huge stratum, something in the foundation of the empire, far exceeding anything that was understood in the church prior to Constantine and Theodosius. This is something where socially, not just individually, deification is possible for any being who inhabits within, understands within the boundaries. All actions become liturgy, become common work. The hours, which is supposed to punctuate our day, is only a reminder of this. But the most insignificant action becomes a matter of liturgy. And of course, we've lost that, making the liturgy seem very esoteric. The Holy Empire, as opposed to its previous versions, was a task, it was an opportunity. Because free will, at least as far as accepting the church, is not vitiated here. But it's made as easy as possible. That doesn't mean that the church wasn't at its core relatively small. See, grace is something that the empire was based on. It was spaced out. It was a constant invitation. It reached a point where the life of the Christian soldier was a very different, but just as important idea of asceticism. The monk and the soldier were two sides of the same coin. It's an active universal action to realize the seeds, so to speak, of grace, which have been, the very fact that Greek was the language of the early church. All the documents we have, almost all the documents we have from the early era were in Greek. First Bible we have was in Greek. It's a husband, a husbandman, to raise up these seeds. But of course, you know, this second period wasn't meant to last, because we do have the split of Rome, the old Rome, in the political sense, I get. So you have an imbalance that arises, two halves of the Christian world, and it goes back far, you know, longer than the 11th century. I personally don't think that the 11th century was all that important. 1054 was not a magic period of time. Patriarch of Constantinople was not a pope. So his policies were for him alone and those churches directly under him. But as far as the empire is concerned, it was very important. You have a disharmonious picture that emerged in the West. The conditions at the beginning, the conditions are taking shape that differ from this universal state liturgy, the universal liturgy, what's characteristic of the true Orthodox kingdom. So you have islands, as he says, that begins to appear, and old laws, the old man continues to emerge. What we all call, you know, desacralization, demystification, which is, you know, a Christian concept. You have the disintegration into institutional aspects of salvation. The preservation of Orthodox unity in the church was essential to maintaining an Orthodox empire, and vice versa. There is still the Orthodox truth in the East, but as the West moved towards apostasy, going beyond what had been laid down, merging the old man in many respects, the strengthening of individual motives and the distortion of the proportion between secular and spiritual dominions. And it proceeds in two directions. I'm quoting directly here. On the one hand, there was a false teaching about the strict hierarchy of the apostles introduced in the West, which leads to the assertion of papism, and theocracy, so to speak, as well as the feudal power of individual secular princes and nobles is being strengthened outside of the idea of the empire, outside of the idea of symphony. And their claims to independence and their personal autocracy is based on the old man, principles that were not part of the Orthodox empire. We see the changes in the religious and the secular order in the West. And in Dugin, of course, they just aggravated the deep process of this mutation. And different man is emerging in the West, what eventually will become the individual, the nominal man, claiming some form of autonomy, seeking dominion. And that can only come from breaking ties with the liturgy, with the so-called common work. Personal salvation is always a strange one, because there isn't just the person. And to a great extent, the concept of the isolated individual salvation is a Western idea, which doesn't recognize that intermediate conciliar idea. So old Rome comes to its own formulation. It outwardly remains Christian, but it does depart, especially about the teaching of the restrainer. The emperor was desacralized, and that became extremely important after Gregory the VII. This eschatological correlation between, you know, secular power and the spiritual dominion, which is what led ultimately to the Great Schism, where gradually the West fell away. Not all at once. It was gradual. I mean, I'm willing to say that you can't go past the sack of Rome in 1204. God's very merciful. And I think the Roman Church, even in that period of time, would be unrecognizable for Catholics today. So what developed in the West, and this is a key point, is this rationalized, desacralized idea about earthly life. And these were seeds that sprouted later on. And so, by the time of the sack of Rome, of East Rome, there were two different worlds that had been created. You see, the concept of purgatory is far more important, I think, than most people realize. Purgatory, of course, exists for those who have already been saved, but because no impure thing can enter heaven, there has to be this period where your sins are somehow burned away. Now, I don't understand how the burning and all this has to do with their sin, with the connection between those two things. But it's this, the clear rejection of purgatory in the East, that put its stamp on these two different worlds that were coming to exist. The new secular idea of the world that was developing, the High Middle Ages, cut off the purgatorial dimension from day-to-day life, our life. When you develop a quantitative composition of the world, yeah, especially with the rise of nominalism in the 14th century, worldly action becomes less and less significant. Our sufferings today are our purgatory. Everything is based on mercy, not on, you know, counting up years, and purgatory became the quantitative core of the Roman Church. So the 11th century, 12th century schism didn't create two equal halves, but it was a falling away. And of course, prior to the 1960s, the Catholics thought the exact same thing in old Rome. It was the cutting away, ultimately, of a damaged part, which not only declared its equivalence to the entire thing, but also claimed superiority over the entire thing. As Dugin would say, this is a confirmation of the final apostasy of the West. But there's an eschatological and ontological meaning of this falling away. Its significance, of course, hasn't waned in the least. And this will eventually provide, over centuries, of course, provide the seeds for Antichrist. Now, this isn't to say that in this period of time there weren't very holy monastics. The foundation of the Carthusians is a very good idea, a very good example. You know, a lot of the hermits were vehemently anti-papal, and for the very same reason. Different parts of the West had different reasons, especially when they began banning the traditional liturgies and put, much later on, the Liturgy of Trent in its place. But then the end of the millennium comes in 1453. It is the separation of the West from a unified Christendom, which led to the sack in 1204, and that never quite, Constantinople never quite recovered. And the millennium comes to an end in 1453. And, of course, the later Italian Renaissance and the rise of alchemy is directly related to all of this. The Caton had been removed by the Turks, working with the Italians and many others. And this paves the road for, you know, the son of perdition to come around. And this is right after the signing of the Florentine Union, which was a recognition of the essential correctness of the Latin world based entirely on mercenary motives. The Union of Florence and the Union of Lyon, this spiritual degeneration where they lost faith entirely. And because of the financial distinctions between Byzantium being poor and the West growing in wealth, these later emperors and scholars become quite malleable. Now, the last emperor was not one of these. I think it's been made clear now the last emperor of Byzantium was not a supporter of Florence and everything that it stood for. But this all comes from the occupation of Byzantium in 1204 and beyond, because it was the Latin occupation that permitted the Byzantines to find out what feudalism is firsthand, which didn't exist prior to that. Now, the next phase is one that makes it specifically Russian, because it is the Moscow phase. Once the millennium was over, it moved north. But after the end of Byzantium, all these components of the full Orthodox world are rediscovered. So Byzantium falls, new Byzantium rises, the last Rome. The Caton is rebuilt, which of course is directly taken from the Byzantine world, as well as the Bulgarian one, but even the Bulgarian one came from the Byzantine one. And Bulgaria is often understated. And it's, you know, they were far closer to Russian Orthodoxy than the Byzantines were. So you have a providential extension into the Third Rome. where all of the fundamental ideas of the true faith are preserved, connected, of course, with what's required: political independence and the rebuilding of symphony. You know, the word of law, or the essay on law and grace by the great Saint Hilarion, the tale of the white cowl, and the work especially of you know, my favorite, Saint Gennadius of Novgorod and Joseph of Valok, expanded on the idea of the third realm. And at least from the time of, it occurred earlier, but directly from Ivan III on, because Ivan III directly married into the Byzantine house. Again, that happened before, but not this directly. That's when the double eagle was hoisted over the Kremlin, etc. The empire is rediscovered. Now, it doesn't negate Constantinople, but Constantinople was to continue to decay, and even in the early modern world, it just wasn't taken seriously at all. The Greek bishop doesn't have any decisive importance in the Turkocratia, all but destroyed the church in the Balkans, which, as you know, my concept of the Bulgarian exarchate and Philotism, etc., is based on this. And so the only functional see in that period of time before the rise of Moscow on the one hand and after the fall of Constantinople was Rome. And as Constantinople, and this is outside of the Russian Empire, as Constantinople continued to fall and they bought their sees and all canonical regularity was lost, they were going west. You had Bulgarians converting to the Roman Church or some uniate version of it, right up until the 19th century. But of course, as always, this comes to an end. And it comes to an end with the New Rite, 1667. It's almost as if these Greeks that have been thrown out of their sees kind of just projected their own post-imperial, so to speak, concepts onto Russia itself. The arrogant contempt for the old Russian Rite, of course, the old Rite being the undistorted continuation of the Byzantine tradition. And it was frozen, of course, at the time when Constantinople went into the Synod of Florence. The old Rite was an older form of the Byzantine Rite, the ancient Studite Charter, and the old believers, of course, accepted its superiority over the modern, the contemporary, I should say, the contemporary Greek form, by the concept of the eschatological teaching about the restrainer. And the rise of the old belief and all of its forms came from this falling away from the second ecclesiastical period. And then, of course, we come to the third. This is the Laodicean verdict, as Dukin says, neither cold nor hot. And it's largely based on the growth of wealth. That there's a, not so much a disappearance, but a concealment of a new life. The new life, in the sense we used the word new before. The imperial reality as the external garb of the church. We know what's happened. Once the empire fell, we know what happened to the church. I mean, the schisms have never ended. Everyone has their own favorite position that they could justify by trying to find, searching for, justifying texts in patristic or canonical tradition. But what happens as the Russian Empire, especially in the 18th century, began to fall, of course, in its final fall, the idea of the grace-filled life becomes not the norm, but the exception. The point of the Holy Kingdom was to transform the world in the same sense that grace transforms the individual. That's the point. The emperor, or I should say the empire, just like the family, as it's an analogous parent in the family, these are meant to be, the emperor has more reality than the individual does. And this is why nominalism is so incredibly important. And so the nature of actual, you know, imperial life goes into folk songs and legend. Hard to access. Remember what the old believers were searching with Kitez. The invisible city that is only visible to those who understand the older conception of empire. So whatever is outside of the church comes from Antichrist, and of course the central role of the Judaics in this development. The world becomes a negative thing. It's still either unconverted or has reverted back to its previous pre-converted state. And the Antichrist develops because wealth and power, which was what the problem in the Garden of Eden was, encourages heresies, encourages schisms. There is an ontological and theological connection to the unity of the church and the unity of empire. Bishops by themselves don't rule anything, and they've done a terrible job since the fall of the empire. So what does Antichrist do here? He, of course, prevents the conversion of the empire or even seeing the empire just as another matter of policy rather than an ontological reality in its own right. The church loses control in a very general sense. There are schisms upon schisms. And the only thing keeping it from decaying entirely, like we have now, is providence. The Caton goes to God himself and the church itself, which is a very rough situation to be in. That's why we can't have an ecumenical synod when you don't have an emperor. But the anti-Byzantine, anti-Moscow, anti-Russian line comes directly from this idea. And then, of course, the Antichrist, as I say, is Adam Kadmon from the Kabbalah, unifies all powers to itself. The consolidation of everything under its control. And we see now with the endless purges, up to and including the murder of Dugin's daughter, as examples, removing, not debating, not understanding, removing anything that goes against this postmodern sickness that we suffer with. So ecclesiology is directly connected with Antichrist or Adam Kadmon, which, of course, is central to theology itself. This is a total dependency. The third ecclesiastical period can be typified by what happened to the old believers, who were more consistent in their preaching than what I call the St. Petersburg theology, or the westernized and masonized conception of the church that you see in the 18th century. The new martyrs of Byron, of Catherine II, and even Peter and Catherine I before. Antichrist isn't necessarily an individual, but it is a conception of the individual. In the Kabbalah and Adam Kadmon, I have an entire lecture on this before. But it's not a secret lawlessness anymore. We're living at the end of the third period. Plans of Antichrist. And remember, the ancient church didn't have the vocabulary to talk about what's going on now. The killings of right-wing opponents, banning political parties all over Europe. Britain is running out of water, while, of course, the executives in the water firms are giving themselves gigantic bonuses. What happens when the third period that we're in comes to an end? This is right about where we are. The purges that we're seeing, everything from military, what's going on against Russia, the purges of military, purges of all social media, the banning of any debate and discussion, the economic attacks on anyone, not even Orthodox people, but anyone who even mildly rejects the transsexual idea in the broad sense. Still, though, if the Soviets couldn't destroy the church, then neither can the regime. Soviets being a more clumsy version of it. Now it's based on psychology. It's based on getting into the heads of the average brainwashed person himself. So what was a secret substratum of darkness now is institutionalized. And the last time typified by the wickedness of the Holy of Holies, placing of the abomination. The Laodicean church is the what Dugin calls the highest stage of alienation. The end of the second period, which is, you know, the Golden Age, begins with the falling away of the West, the collapse of Constantinople, and then the dragging of Moscow to St. Petersburg. Only, of course, in 1918, having its final, in World War One, and everything that World War One represented, in terms of the domination of science and everything else. So it was a long time in dying, but all of these things were manifestations of the old world. None of this means, however, that the church has failed. However, the unity of the empire certainly hasn't done tremendous damage to the church. In fact, I'll show you many patristic ideas talking about the extreme, if not impossibility, the extreme difficulty of maintaining any kind of ecclesial unity outside of an empire. It was just taken for granted. And it was taken for granted, even politically, that the emperor was considered the spokesman for the church. And we could even talk about, you know, what happened in, you know, the ninth hour restoration of the Patriarchate in 1917, the declaration of Sergius, and I've never condemned him for this, because we all would have done the same thing if that's what we were facing. If we were facing not only our own being tortured to death, but those of everyone around us. So I don't make this, it's not a moral failing of his, but it did have ramifications, symbolic ramifications, ontological ramifications that we're still feeling today. How many Orthodox churches, you know, they're wearing the stupid masks and they're claiming that you could taint the Eucharist with COVID, whatever the trendy cause that they're promoting now. And this comes directly from, not only from, but in modern terms, directly from Sergius's acceptance of Soviet power as God-bearing. Of course, the church said this about the white forces too. The provisional government also is from God. Unfortunately, many of the great hierarchs of Russia signed that document. So Sergius wasn't all that new. So the murder of Daria Dugina, has everything to do and is symbolic for us in the world that we live in. She is not going to be the last. I said in the beginning that the sloppy nature of this operation, I think, was done on purpose. Oh, by the way, when was the last time you heard of ISIS? You know, I should have said that in the beginning. ISIS has totally disappeared. Have you noticed this? You need any more evidence that that was a something that the West created and that the Israelis created? All of a sudden, they're gone. A couple years ago, they were going to take over the planet, like everyone the West dislikes. Now, of course, they have no relevance. And, of course, a lot of this does have to do with Afghanistan going to its righteous government, as well as the actions of Iran. But it's gone. Again, showing the fraud typical of this era. I think next week I do want to talk about chaos in Dugin, because this has everything to do with the distinction. There's a magnification of the third period that we're coming to the end of, that we live in now. And that's the distinction between modernity and post-modernity. Now, it's been a while since not really that long. I've done, you know, Foucault and Baudrillard, the pioneers of post-modernity. But what that has to do with ontology, and of course, nominalism, and my book on nominalism, we'll talk about next week. Chaos doesn't mean disorder. I'll just say that much. You know, there is clearly similarities between the pre-imperial and post-imperial churches. But of course, the differences are substantial. Yeah, you know, capitalism, technology, the power of the Jews, the mass organization of state resources, of the growth of media control in the conglomerate. Even Roman at its worst is utopia compared to how we live. So the similarities between the two are only on the surface. I don't want to ignore them. But this third, I think we're coming to the end of this third period, precisely in the schism between modernity and post-modernity. We're back to the relationship between the church and the world. the attacks on the Caton, the attacks on monarchy, the attacks on the empire, are simply being replicated in its attacks on the nation. Now, the idea of the right wing, I use the term, has to do with the rejection of the individual. That reality is to be found in organic communities, the empire being the highest, at least politically speaking, socially speaking, but just below it, the nation. And with, you know, strong leadership, like you have only in a few places, it can replicate because the church is so wedded and so embedded in ethnicity, which directly comes from the empire. But it can offer a second best. You know, nationalism exists in a hierarchy of values. Right now, again, you see this in Revelations 2, the Laodicean church doesn't even know where it fell from. It doesn't see itself as fallen at all. This is why you hear in the OCA these condemnations of talking about the end times. Maybe not so much anymore, but a few years ago it was. Because they're just beginning. This is progress. The attacks on monarchy are now simply the attacks on nation. Nation, kingdom, monarchy, again, a hierarchy of value. The empire was based on nations, with, of course, the Greek in the ascendant role. Monarchies tend to be ethnic. So, the imposition of the Soviet system was just as rotten and just as evil as the imposition of postmodernity with the fall of the Soviet system. It allowed control to be more diffuse. But even that era is coming to an end. It's one of the things the Great Reset and COVID is, and how the ontological symbolism of the specifically postmodern era, you know, starting maybe in the late 70s. The nation now has taken over the concept of the Caton, and the same liberal orthodoxy, who doesn't remember where they fell from, or that they've fallen at all. We have great, one of the central concepts of the left is that man can save himself. That is to say, the elite can save itself. Adam Cadman can save itself. The features of Antichrist in Bolshevism, the concept is indisputable. But even in the liberal West, the apostasy is far greater and far more thoroughgoing because it's a psychological one. But we're coming to the end even of this third period in the sense that the decay and breakdown of the Caton now has been reconstituted into its opposite. The BlackRock tightly centralized conglomerate that rules us in every turn. And we'll end here with Dugin's own words on the ecclesiastical characteristics of the church that has to do battle, the truncated church that has to do battle now on earth with Adam Cadman and Antichrist. That church has to recognize Byzantium and Moscow as theological entities, the millennial kingdom, that it understands Western apostasy and what nominalism is and what the connection between those two things is. And that the falling away of the Western world was the beginning of the end of the second golden age, the second period, the golden age. Three, that the church regards Moscow as an extension, as I said, of Byzantium, with all the same consequences accruing to it. Also, four, that there is an irreversibility of the Russian schism, accepting the old believer's understanding of what modernity is as far as Russia is concerned. And the 1666 breakdown of the Third Rome. And finally, that the trends that exist in this fight, the old believers, the Russian Orthodox Church in exile in its true sense, the true Orthodox, at least in certain manifestations, that they bear in themselves aspects of ecclesiology. The old believers tend to be more cutting in that regard. But a positive thing is that the Moscow Patriarchate has began to understand its role in the world. And the murder of Dugina now may just be the final nail in the coffin. That it's not going to be this WCC entity. bunch of old men appointed by the Soviets are long gone. We're in no position to reject assistance from any quarter. But these are the things that the battle against the anti-Rome, or this now centralized, institutionalized Antichrist, Adam Kadmon, creating its own sense. I mean, Adam Kadmon is the new man in the Judaic sense, in Antichrist sense. These are the ingredients that this battle, that the church has to have in understanding this war. So I went through all of that in light of the recent assassination, in light of what's been happening to us. Well, it really was started in the 80s, but really went into high gear during COVID, which of course was, it was not exactly a pandemic. It was just nonsensical. Monkeypox, which is purely a gay disease, just another variation of smallpox. Because it brings in sharp relief what our situation is. Now, we're going to talk about the distinction between modern and postmodern next week, but it's extremely important to know how we got here in a very general sense. I've dealt with very specific senses too, but this is a general overview of where we are in 2022. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.